Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. The Arkansas Symphony Orchestra's Inc. Intimate Neighborhood Concert Series is a most successful addition to the symphony season. Initiated in January 2013, that concert, the first in the series, is also memorable for the guest soloist, organist Justin Bischoff, performing the concerto by Francis Poulenc. Dr. Bischoff is particularly noted for his exceptional ability as an improviser on the organ keyboards, which we heard when he followed the concerto with an encore on the initials Philip Mann, Arkansas Symphony's music director-conductor. Justin Bischoff returns to Little Rock this week in the closing concert of the 2015-16 Inc. season with Toccata Festiva by Samuel Barber. So today he is my guest, and when asked, filled in some of his early days for me.
Let's see, I started piano when I was three, and I'm told I was quite precocious and loved the music. My mother was a pianist. She was an amateur pianist. And then I started the organ at about 14 when we were still in Toronto, and then I moved to Montreal for high school and continued the organ, and along with that was choral conducting. Orchestral conducting I started about 14 years ago, working on it, studying it, and then gradually building up a career with that. But it's been a continual crescendo.
Well, you've answered my questions, of course, that with all these connections to Canada in your Canadian Chamber Orchestra in New York City, and concerts and things in Ottawa and Vancouver, that you had to have roots in Canada.
Yes, my mother was Canadian, and my father was Swiss. He came over to Canada when he was in his 30s. And so they met, and I was born in Toronto. As I said, high school was in Montreal. And then at age 18, I came to the big bad New York City to go to Manhattan School of Music as an organist. In fact, I haven't done nearly as much in Canada as I would like to do. And it's something I need to and want to focus more on.
Well, that background is nice that you bring these touches in, as you say. And you do this Canadian Chamber Orchestra, founded to promote Canadian artistry.
Yes. I mean, here's the thing. Like, when people establish an orchestra, sometimes, how do I put this? It's a little bit too sort of self-serving. And so they don't want the Justin Bischoff Orchestra kind of thing. And I am Canadian, so I called it the Canadian Chamber Orchestra. Many of the players are not Canadian, and we do other works besides Canadian works. But over the years, I have made a point of trying to promote Canadian works and Canadian artists. So it's part of the theme. It's not the whole theme, if that makes sense.
No, of course. And you do a very significant program with that particular unit for the lives of children through music.
Yes, it's really important to me. Basically, music is a transforming force in the world, and you've probably heard that expression. And it's been talked about a lot recently. I've always felt that way. And so having an orchestra, bringing great players together, making music is a wonderful thing, but I wanted to also use that as a tool to help others. And so we just finished our 9th, hard to believe, annual concert where up here in Scarsdale, which is just north of New York City, about 15 miles, where we bring members of the church, where I had the orchestra based, and members of the synagogue where I used to work, and we come together to help very at-risk children in a town called Mount Vernon, which is very nearby. And the goal is we raise money to send them to a life-altering summer camp so that during the year they're in a program that helps them, but in the summer the program ends, and it's such a crucial time, and it's also just it changes their lives. So it's one of those expressions I don't like, but win-win. We present a first-class, wonderful concert while at the same time raising as much money as we can to send these children to camp. Mm-hmm. And I have several wonderful donors, supporters who help underwrite it so that when people buy tickets, all the ticket sales goes to the cause. And I have an amazing partner in crime named Dorothy Ewer, who is the benefit chair. It makes this all possible with me. And, last year we cleared $70,000for the kids, and we're still collecting for this year. But and then next year, of course, is our big tent So it's a wonderful endeavor, I think, for the musicians. And, you know, a lot of my players, when I found out the orchestra, were in their 20s, and now they're in their 30s, and they've become quite busy. But they all say they, you know, make time to do this concert because they enjoy the music making as well as the cause.
Going back to you and your progress from and up to the organ, you kept with the organ. And I wondered, did you find that it became not so much an instrument to master, to work with, almost as an alter ego, that you could work on the organ in ways that other instruments didn't provide, and it was almost like having a friend?
I can see where you're coming from. On the surface, it's kind of the opposite, because every instrumentalist, almost every instrumentalist, owns their instrument, and they travel, and they go, if they're a concert flutist, concert violinist, it's theirs. It's in their home. They practice with it. It's part of their body, basically, and they can go to a strange, cold concert hall somewhere, but they have their instrument. And if you're a pianist at a certain level, your piano can travel with you. An organist, yes, you can have your home organ in terms of if you're based at a cathedral or a church, but when you go on the road, like I will be doing next week in Little Rock, you come upon a new instrument, and you have a couple days to acclimate with it and then to make music with it. Now, organists who enjoy that, obviously, we enjoy the challenge of that and the sort of making a new friend and making music with an instrument that you have not, you know, ever played before and may never play again, depending. So when you have your own organ, and it's like, then sure, it's like your instrument that you practice every day and you have access to. You have to sort of make new friends constantly. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Even more so, as you say, because sometimes you can come back to the same piano or a piano very much similar to whatever, considering
but, pianists have that, but it's organists and pianists who have the challenge.
Yes, but at least most organs that you are required to play in a concert of some kind wouldn't be subject to some of the extremes of use that the pianos are given to pianists when they're...
Well, that's interesting. You know, again, you're coming at it from an interesting point of view, which makes sense, and then I actually think of the opposite as, you know, that sort of to go with that, which is, sure, like when you have pianos, especially in conservatories, my goodness, they get used for 10, 12 hours a day, and they have to be constantly maintained. An organ, for the most part, is not going to be used that intensely, other than in a sort of practice situation in a conservatory. That being said, organs are, you know, have thousands of pipes and parts, and they're, you know, even the small organ is quite massive, and they require constant maintenance to be sure that everything's working properly. And if the temperature goes up too many degrees, the whole thing's out of tune, and you have to retune it. So it doesn't get worn down, but it requires, you know, it's a several ton instrument with lots of moving parts.
You're right.
So that there is that, and that's, and you have to stay on it. Like when institutions and churches, you know, if they have financial problems or they just don't focus as much as they should, you know, it'll catch up with them, and all of a sudden, 20 years later, you've got an organ with a lot of problems. But if you just do regular maintenance, then it can stay in good shape.
Yeah. So you talked about conducting and orchestras, and I was intrigued that you had founded the Modus Opera Company. When did you get caught up in conducting opera?
Oh, I love opera. I have not done as much in recent years just because of scheduling, and I'm it's also on my list. I'm missing it. I love opera. I mean, I'm a pianist as well, and have accompanied singers and done choral music for, you know, since I was 14, and I just love opera. So I thought, I had a couple of friends who were willing to help underwrite it in New York City, and I wanted to come up with a fun name, so my modus operandi was to call it Modus, and we did several productions, and I had different recitals with different singers, and I've done some guest conducting for opera. In 2008, I had the privilege of conducting the Australian premiere of The Crucible by Robert Ward. When we did the production in 2008, it was at WAPA, the Western Australian Academy of Performing Arts, and so it was a graduate student production, and we had a wonderful phone, you know, group phone thingy, conference call, that's what it is, with the cast and Robert Ward, and he talked about that, and that Arthur Miller said that this opera, how did he put it? He said what you said, that it made it better, and that he said if he could write music, he would much prefer to write opera than plays, because he says it conveys the story that much more powerfully, or something to that effect. which is inspiring. And of course, it won the Pulitzer for music.
I know,
which was quite an exciting thing. And they had never done it in Australia, so it was a wonderful national sort of exposure. And I recently just did before our ninth children's benefit concert. Barbara, the Knoxville summer of 1915, mm-hmm. soprano and orchestra, and we brought the soprano over, who was my lead then. She's now at the Royal Opera in London. And so we got to reunite after 8 years, and she came and was the soprano soloist. So it was a nice sort of coming around of events.
Yes. What's her name? So I can
Skye Ingram, fantastic singer. Just, yeah, words fail me. She is, her career is going well, and it's going to continue to go much, even better, and yeah, she donated her services, and it was her symphonic debut. She's done opera with orchestra, but this was her first concert piece with orchestra, and she was amazing.
Well, I hope you recorded that wonderful sort of
round robin. Oh, yes, we do a nice one, professional recording with many, many cameras and a great engineer, and we give that to donors and also as a way to continue to try to raise money for the next one.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, it never ends.
But I was interested also when you... Well, it's mentioned in the sheet of paper, maybe this isn't exactly accurate, but that the concerts or the operas that you started off in your conducting of opera were Mozart.
Yes. We did Così, and then Giovanni, and then the big production was Figaro. And it's not that Mozart is easy. Mozart's very, you know, to get the style perfectly and to convey the musical message, it requires a lot of elegance on the part of the players and singers. So that's difficult. But at the same time, they're, you know, the Beaumarchais, they're phenomenal librettos and phenomenal music, and they don't need 17 trombones and 5 tubas and all of that. So you can do it with a real chamber orchestra.
Yeah.
So that helps when you're doing things at a smaller scale.
Well, this is often the case with some of the things that came down to the 20th century from the Victorian era, where they had humongous orchestras. And I remember a recording that Toscanini made with basically the same musicians that Handel had created for Messiah.
Right.
And everybody was astounded at what it should sound like.
I mean, Handel, some of his had huge orchestras, but more of the performances now from that period were, you know, smaller.
So... coming back now to the Barber Toccata, is it Toccata Festiva or mm-hmm. Festiva?
You know, I have always called it Toccata Festiva. Maybe Festiva is more Italian sounding, but Festiva. I've heard it many different ways. I don't know the answer. I think it's just, yeah, that works well together, and that's normally how I say it.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful piece.
Yes, but what was so interesting, I went to my Latin dictionary. I went to my Italian dictionary. Neither of them had much to say about toccata. So I went to the Harvard dictionary, and they just had quite a lot to say. But what was so interesting was it means actually touch or tap or bell or drum or something. But in early days, like 16th century, 1600s or something, that it was a prelude that an organist would start to play before actually playing. Out of his head, he had to create something entirely immediate.
I love improvisation. I do it extensively. And actually, on the concert next week, mm-hmm. I will do an improvisation after the toccata, after the barber. And when I was here, I thought it was 2 or 3 years ago, when the symphony inaugurated the chamber series,
right?
Philip had become, as you know, and I did the Poulenc organ concerto together, and then I did an improvisation on Philip Mann. I took the letters of his name and made a theme out of it. So I'm thinking of doing something similarly next week. But the toccata is one of the earliest keyboard forms, and you're right, it does mean touch piece, and it is traditionally something that is a little bit more virtuosic. You can have a prelude, you can have a toccata, but a toccata is meant to be more, it's just more virtuosic.
But it was kind of intriguing to read the statement about it in the dictionary.
Right.
It was considered very, you must be seen to be improvising.
Yeah,
in other words,
exactly.
You could not come with anything that looked as though it had been pre-recorded or anything like that.
It's interesting, yeah, and without getting, you know, I could talk for improvisation for a long time, but, you know, back in the day, as in the Baroque and into the classical period and the Romantic, most musicians could improvise. And now, you know, it's coming back into favor or interest or focus, which makes me happy, but by the time the 20th century came along, it was organists and jazz musicians were the ones who improvised. Organists because of church, because you have to fill in liturgical sort of dead moments. The French especially have had that tradition and have kept it, and the French organists are, you know, fantastic improvisers.
What in this particular piece is outstanding?
Oh, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it's, even though it's called a toccata, it has a lot, and it's a lot of, you know, extrovert and celebratory moments. There's a lot of lyrical, reflective music in it, which is so Barber. So the second theme, which you'll hear early in the beginning of the piece, is just classic Barber. Barber wrote for the voice brilliantly, and I always think of that. It's so lyrical, it's so vocal when you hear his sort of quieter themes. Also, it has a two-page pedal cadenza where you just use your feet. And it's quite extensive, so that's a lot of fun, because not many pieces have that. I mean, there are not that many organ concertos like this to begin with, and second of all, for that kind of extended pedal cadenza, I love it. It's a real high point.
Well, that must be quite intriguing, because an organist has to wear special organ shoes, don't you?
Well, yes, I actually wear dance shoes from Capizio, which is a store here in New York, or maybe it's a chain, I don't know. Basically, and they're different, people have different opinions, but mostly you wear them, they have like a leather bottom as opposed to plastic or rubber or something that will go sliding. And also it has to fit your feet tightly, not in terms of the tightness of the laces, but conform to your feet. You can't have huge, wide pieces of plastic sticking out around the side of your foot, you're going to hit more than one note. Mm-hmm. So it has to be it has to fit to your feet.
They're made specially for you?
No. There's a company called Organ Master Shoes you can get, or a lot of organists get them from the dance company, Capizio. That's what I've always done.
Yes. Well, having had a child as a dancer, Capizio shoes.
Yeah, it's pretty ubiquitous. And
it's also worn out very quickly. So what we're looking forward to, there are two Barber pieces on the program. There's the Adagio, which is the slow movement of the string quartet, isn't it?
Well, he wrote the Adagio for strings. He wrote an Adagio for strings, and then it's been transcribed and done by all sorts of different permutations. And it's interesting, he wrote that earlier in his career, before the Second War, and it was sort of in the 30s when he was always working. He was very successful. But that was sort of his earlier period. And then you get sort of after the Second World War, there were a lot of sort of more mature masterworks like the Cello Concerto or the Prayers of Kierkegaard, the Knoxville I mentioned, and also the Opera Vanessa, which is amazing. So the Adagio is from his earlier period. And everybody knows it even though they don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the Platoon movie, you know, that's the music in that movie, it's used a lot. It's quite famous. And it's tricky to play.
Is that because of what?
Tuning, and it's the register with the orchestra. It gets higher and higher, and cellos are way, way up. And it's it's just tricky to do well. It's done a lot because it's such a powerful piece of music. But it can push, you know, a lesser orchestra. But I mean, your orchestra is fantastic, so I'm very much looking forward to it. I know it's going to be wonderful.
That was organist Justin Bischoff, who comes back to Little Rock on Thursday, May the 19th, to play Samuel Barber's Toccata Festiva on the final concert of the 2015-16 Inc. season, 7 p.m. in Christ Episcopal Church on Scott Street in downtown Little Rock. For tickets, call 501-666-1761 or online arkansassymphony.org. Next weekend, May 20th through 22nd, Friday through Sunday, the Arkansas Arts Center Children's Theatre will be awash in characters from the ever-popular story Peter Pan, as created by Arkansas Festival Ballet in its annual storybook presentation. Apart from the traditional nutcracker at Christmas time, these spring gifts to the young in Little Rock are among the few to be found presented with the care and attention to detail given by Festival Ballet's artistic director and choreographer, Rebecca Starker. Executive director of the company, Janet Aronson, is my second guest. To give us some idea of what goes on behind the scenes and some of the other events which have involved the company this season.
We did a performance, it was in March or early April, with the Conway Symphony, and that was sort of an add-on. They were doing Romeo and Juliet, and the Arkansas Shakespeare Theater was collaborating with them, so we came in as the third collaborator and staged the well-known pas de deux balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet. So it was just an additional element that we don't normally do. And then that
is a nice little extra thing, though, to do something with those other partners and material that you haven't worked on before.
And it's always an interesting challenge to work with limited stage space and to have the juxtaposition with the actors. So it's something new. It's always a wonderful opportunity for our dancers. And it presents some choreographic challenges because of the space. But Rebecca always manages to pull it off beautifully. Showcase for Dancers really was right on the heels of our participation in Regional Dance America Southwest Festival, which again is a big undertaking, organizing the dancers to go and having them be prepared to do the piece that's performed at the festival.
Because within that framework of years, that's when they're often looking to other things going on in the festivals that they can go mm-hmm. to, look to Joffrey and a few others.
Right. And in fact, most of them go off for the summer, two intensive programs. We've got four going off to American Ballet Theater this summer. We've got a couple that were accepted to Joffrey South. It's when they need to go and really do that intensive training. The dancers who go off and do the summer training come back so strong and always with improved technique. Mm-hmm. And they always benefit from having different instructors. I think that's important for the dancers. And so they come back just that much more excited and on their game.
And the festival itself, when they go off to that, mm-hmm. they usually bring in some pretty well-known and impressive teachers.
They do. So they have wonderful teachers, and they're taking class with their peers from other companies, which is a good eye-opener for many of them, and it certainly encourages them to work hard on their technique and their artistry.
How many of the company are actually, by now, very accomplished dancers?
We have a couple of resident male dancers who are college graduates, so they are on the older end, and then we have a contingent of about seven dancers who are, in the range of 14 to 17. We're fortunate that we still have them for another year or so before some of them venture off to college.
Now they come back and they're going full steam ahead to Peter Pan. Is this something that Rebecca has created out of the story?
Rebecca did original choreography for our 2010 production of Peter Pan. She used music primarily at that time from a composer who had been with the Cincinnati Ballet, and he had composed the music specifically for their production of Peter Pan. But she did all the original choreography, and much of that choreography is the same for this production in 2016. However, she has added a few different scenes and, moved things around a little bit. She does that based in part on which dancers she has available to her and where they are in terms of their training and technique and what we think we have in terms of costume capability. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that goes into determining how to tweak the story. But basically, it follows the classic story of Peter Pan, and it does follow largely what she had done in 2010.
Yeah. So you have enough principles to pursue.
We do. We are fortunate. We have a very good, strong core of dancers right now. Then we have a nice group of what we call our apprentice dancers who are in the age range of about 12 to 14, and they have been meticulously trained by our ballet mistress, Melinda Tobian, and they are together. Their technique is strong. They really have it together.
Has she cast Peter with a male or a female dancer?
With a male, Matthew Morley, who has danced many lead roles with us. He's an accomplished young man. He guests at various companies throughout the region, especially during the holiday season for Nutcracker. And he's got outstanding stage presence and is very good at partnering. So there's a very comical scene with Captain Hook where there's some spoof type of partnering. He does it really well.
So how many dancers will there be on stage altogether?
We have a total of about 60 dancers. That includes some of our young students who don't have huge roles, but they have important roles, and they dance roles like we've got jellyfish and sea clams and little sort of pirates in training. So all told, about 60 dancers.
Goodness, goodness. Then the music that she's always used when she and I have talked has been a particular composer.
Yes.
Who's already got works sort of semi-persuaded by his talent.
Right.
That she works very well with. Is this the same one this year?
In terms of the composer of mm-hmm. the music?
And the music.
She's using music by Carmen de Leon, who was the music director for Cincinnati Ballet. So she's pulled from his music that he composed for Cincinnati's production of Peter Pan. She pulls music that she thinks lends itself very well to the storyline, to what she envisions for her choreography, and music that is very engaging for the audience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And very suitable for whatever actions are happening on stage.
Yes, yes. And it flows well. And, you know, we try to make these storybook ballets very appealing to families.
Now, Captain Hook.
Captain Hook, he is played by Dennis Glasscock. He was our Captain Hook in 2010. He does it with full-out style, lots of drama, lots of comedy. He plays it to the hilt. And he wears an amazingly wonderful costume. So he really is all over the stage and very much center stage when he's on. He's been in so many performances throughout the region. He's just got amazing stage presence. And not only does the audience respond well to him, but the dancers on stage really play off of him. And so it adds tremendously to the drama. We also have Eric Harrison, who will be Captain Hook's sidekick, Smee. He also appeared in our production in 2010. And again, he has a lot of theater experience, so he plays off nicely with the other dancers on stage. We very much enjoy having him on the stage with us.
That's great. Then the music, when it's put together, do you have a technician or does Rebecca do all that?
Rebecca really puts it all together. We do have a tech at the Children's Theater at the Arts Center who runs the sound for us. But in terms of putting it all together, getting it prepared, Rebecca really does all of that.
And you've got how many performances?
We have 4 public performances. In addition, we have 4 school performances on Thursday the 19th and Friday the 20th. Those are in the morning, and we appeal to school groups, in many cases, groups that wouldn't otherwise go to a performance. We price the tickets so that they're very affordable. And we have a huge group coming up this year from Monticello and Star City.
Janet Aronson, Executive Director of Arkansas Festival Ballet, which presents Peter Pan's Storybook Ballet at the Arkansas Arts Center Children's Theater, 9th and Commerce Street in Little Rock, May 20th through 22nd. 4 school performances, May 19th and 20th, at 10 a.m. and noon each day, precede the public performances, Friday, May the 20th at 7:30 p.m., Saturday, 21st, 2 and 7:30 p.m., and Sunday, 2 p.m., For tickets, call 501-227-5320 or online arkansasdance.org. The Arkansas Arts Center Children's Theater box office will not be handling Peter Pan tickets. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.